Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning host, Daniel Dotti.
Hi, John. It is terrific to be back.
Daniel, you were here, of course, for the Scarlet Letter, and as one of the few hosts I have who actually enjoys reading 19th century prose, I had to have you back on for this special episode about Poe.
Yeah, absolutely. At first I thought, well, you know, am I pigeonholing myself as the 19th century Gothic contributor? But then I realized, of course, Shannon Camp did Wuthering Heights, which is, of course, the sine qua non of Gothic literature. So I don't know. Maybe I might come back and do something else besides. But, you know, honestly, I really do enjoy this 19th century Gothic style writing I've discovered. This is you've led me on a journey, John. I love it.
This time we are doing two short stories by Edgar Allan Poe. Now, if you were in high school, you probably read two or three stories by Poe, and you probably had to read either The Raven or Annabel Lee for his poetry. I believe most people are most familiar with The Cask of Amontillado, and we didn't do that. But I did want to mention that because the legend is that Poe got the idea from that story while he was here in Boston. Apparently a couple of soldiers walled up another soldier that they were upset with for having killed someone else in a duel on Castle Island here in Boston. So
wow.
I just wanted to put that plug in there. And
everybody, come visit Boston for their macabre monuments.
and also to kind of step into, we won't go too deeply into Poe's biography. He's obviously one of the seminal authors of American literature. But I do think it's interesting, if you come here to Boston, just I think 3 or 4 years ago, they put up a large monumental statue to Poe here in Boston. Now, Poe was born in Boston and almost immediately left for Virginia after his father left him, and then his mom died, and it was within about a year's time he was living with an uncle and aunt in Virginia. He grew up there, and then most of his literary life was spent in Baltimore, Maryland. But what I think is fascinating is each of these cities in turn wants to claim Poe as their own.
a bit like with the Wright brothers, which are, I believe, claimed by at least North Carolina and Ohio and probably more.
Benjamin Franklin similarly was born in Boston, then moved to Philadelphia. So if you go to there's like a big burying ground on the Freedom Trail in Boston that has this enormous Franklin monument, and people always coming by and say, oh, look, that's where Benjamin Franklin is buried. And I always have to say, no, that's not where he's buried. But they pointedly just put Franklin on the monument so it can be.
I like imagining you as a drive-by pedant for all these these gawking tourists.
Well, it's likely if you're out on a summer's walk at the Freedom Trail, I'll be there trying to explain the finer points of the Ether Monument.
Right, desperately trying to correct every misapprehension one might hear, which will be a shocking amount if I know my tour groups.
Poe did do most of his writing in Baltimore. I believe it was here that he wrote the two short stories that we did this time, which are going to be The Fall of the House of Usher, which was from, what was the year of that? 1839.
39, yeah.
And after that, we'll do The Mask of the Red Death, which is 1841, I think.
I have the book I have here says it was first appeared in Graham's Magazine in 1842.
Okay. So these are two stories that get read a lot in high school. And more importantly, these were stories you read in high school, right?
Yeah, exactly. These were of the sort of my experience with Poe has been almost entirely limited to school assigned reading. Which is actually going to, much like the scales, you know, fell from my eyes about Nathaniel Hawthorne. I think I will, like I said, you're leading me on this journey into 19th century Gothic Americana. But yeah, my own personal experience with Poe had been Well, really, if we're being honest, my first exposure to Poe would have been the Raven segment, the Raven poem segment on the very first Simpsons Halloween special, The Treehouse of Horror, from 1990, I believe. And that was my very first exposure to Edgar Allan Poe. But after that, of course, I believe beginning in middle school, I think we first read, say, The Raven and Annabelle Lee. I may have had to memorize Annabelle Lee at some point. That is, and knowledge is long gone. But in high school, I do distinctly remember that we read Mask of the Red Death. We also read Fall of the House of Usher. And I think in at least one class, we watched the, I want to say 1964, Roger Corman, Vincent Price movie version of Mask of the Red Death, which when I was reading it, and I was shocked that anyone could find 90 minutes worth of material out of the story. But of course, you know, sort of looking back, I haven't watched it in years, and doing a little, I got curious and did a little research, and it turns out that they actually folded, they made subplots out of a number of separate Poe stories that they folded into their movie version. But it had literally been about, 15, 18, 20 years since I had read these pieces before I returned to them. And I was surprised by how much of the imagery I retained. I did not recall very much of any of the plot points, which I realize now makes sense because there's not a terrific amount of plot to be had in either of the works. But, yeah.
I think what you say about the Corman movie is quite interesting because there are other famous Poe movies. There was the Pendulum. Mm-hmm. There was a Black Cat, which has absolutely nothing to do with the short story of the Black Cat. And Poe is one of those authors that just exists in the ether. We're all so inundated with him in this culture. But it is, I think, valuable to go back and read his work, and particularly to read some of these works that may not get covered as much. Now, the Fall of the House of Usher and the Mask of the Red Death are actually fairly anthologized, but they aren't. I don't think they are at the level of Amontillado or the Pendulum. Maybe that's just me thinking that way. But one of the things that I really liked about these two stories when we read them together was they underscore the way that Poe really wasn't very interested in being didactic or moralistic. Mm-hmm. It's very easy when you read other works like The Telltale Heart, for example. That seems like a fairly standard.
Yeah, very well known and anthologized one. Yeah,
that's sort of a standard morality play almost. Right. but when you read these two stories together, you are struck by the utter strangeness of Poe's vision, because there are these images that seem to be coalescing around a theme, and then when you think you know what the theme is, it kind of confounds that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like you feel as though there's an allegory here, but you can't quite get your finger on what that allegory is.
which again puts to the lie the idea that there is an allegory, because I mean, that's an allegory. I think strictly is more or less, I've always thought of it, conceived of it as a very obvious symbolism. You know, is sort of how I picture allegory. But yeah, this is, you're right. It's a little. I'm not enough of a Poe scholar to know how intentional this might be, but it almost puts you off your footing that you are treated to a number of very strong images, very clear sort of refrains almost in these works. And so you think it's, again, like it's leading up to some sort of, you know, like it, you know, it'll turn out to be XYZ in the end, but it doesn't coalesce. So that in itself is almost a kind of, it adds an extra layer of unease to these stories, which are themselves already dedicated to some very macabre imagery and ideas.
Right. If you do any reading in Poe, you will very quickly come across an essay that he wrote called The Philosophy of Composition, which is supposed to be his process for writing, and he describes the way in which he conceived of The Raven, and then talks about what he's doing, where he puts forth his whole idea that's very famously quoted, that all stories have to have a unity of effect, that they all should move towards a single effect, and then once you achieve that effect, you just end it because there's nothing more to do.
Yeah.
But the thing that I find fascinating about that is he talks about that, how he says, what is the most moving subject? It is death. And he goes, but how can it be the most emotionally involving subject possible if it's about the death of a beautiful woman? Therefore, I decided that that was the most poetical subject ever, and so he wrote The Raven. And I think I can imagine the Fall of the House of the Usher coming to Poe as sort of that final scene of the house falling.
Yeah.
And then it's like everything else that leads up to it is just there to achieve that effect.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I don't think he really cares that much about what it means. Although, as we go through, as I read it, I just kept looking for something, you know, because there's so many little tidbits out there that lead you in directions, you know.
Right, like it has to mean something, right? I mean, it's very confidently constructed, and I think that's part of what leads one, at least, you know, I as a reader, it leads me to believe, like, okay, you know, maybe I'm missing something, because it seems like an awful lot of thought went into this, you know. But I think you're right. Yeah, that kind of, right, like, he has in mind an effect, a scene, an emotion to convey, and then everything is sort of a wind up to that pitch. And I think, yeah, I'm glad Mr. Poe explained himself to us, because I think that actually, that illuminates quite a bit of these stories.
The other thing that I think links these two stories together, and a lot of Poe's work, and also relates it in a funny way to someone like Nathaniel Hawthorne, who also was writing it about the same time with some of the same approach, is this fascination with old world imagery. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this kind of a fantasia of European decadence that goes on in both of these stories,
yeah,
you know, of the crumbling European nobility. By this time, Poe was writing in the mid-19th century. America has been its own thing for long enough now, but it is still looking back to the old world for its literary models.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only when you get published in Europe as an American that you can be said to have made it. And that was one of the things that marked Hawthorne, for example. He was the first American novelist that got published in Europe. Widely. I mean, other...
Right, right.
But and I think that Poe also had these designs, but his Europe is this kind of this fantasy Cinderella's castle Europe. You know, it never... In The Fall of the House of Usher, we don't really even know where this is or what this is.
That it actually took me in reading The Fall of the House of Usher. I initially the Fall of the House of Usher is written in a first person voice, and we never get any information about the point of view character other than he went to school in his youth with was it Frederick Usher?
Roderick.
Yeah, Roderick Usher. So it's a very, you know, it's very much a, you know, a kind of reader surrogate. I mean, you know, even more so than most first person point of view characters. But it actually took me a minute. I think it was sort of spoken aside at one point in the Fall of the House of Usher about how, you know, some certain sector of the house had been used in feudal times as a dungeon, and that was the first sort of confirmation, like, okay, we're talking about an old world, like this is in a dreary old England or Ireland or something at this point, because you mentioned Hawthorne, and I think that's a very good sort of touchstone on this. You know, America had been its own thing for long enough to have a sense of antiquity, and Hawthorne, I think, writes, especially in that customs house portion introducing the Scarlet Letter, of which I think I am the only fan in the world, he was very interested in cultivating that sense of decaying antiquity in an American setting. And so I was actually a little unclear with The Fall of the House of Usher whether it was supposed to be some sort of, you know, decaying and dying out old, like, Knickerbocker family, perhaps, or something, like some of the old aristocracy of New York or something like that. But it comes to pass that it was, you know, somewhere that had a feudal past of some sort.
The titular House of Usher means two things. The narrator points out that it means both the family name of Usher, the genealogical term of the House of Usher, and it means the manor house.
Mm-hmm.
And it rises up, we're told, out of a tarn, which is a mountainous lake, a lake that's created by the rivulets of glacial erosion. And I think that is a Celtic designation. So mm-hmm. it may be redolent with, say, Scotland or Ireland, but Usher, I don't know. Usher is that's where does that come from?
Aside from world famous R&B artist Usher,
exactly.
I know the term best from the Irish Archbishop Usher, who right. calculated the age of the universe to having begun on an October Tuesday morning in 4004 BC. So I would imagine, though, that a name like Usher probably ends up amongst the blue bloods on all sides of the Irish Sea. So, I mean, what's important, I think, to Poe and to the effect of the story is that this is some wind-blasted, perhaps a rocky promontory, one of the sort of, ones jutting out into the, near the Hebrides Islands or something in Scotland, nice and storm-tossed.
Now, again, there's very little plot. The narrator shows up at the behest of Roderick Usher, whom he has not seen since his childhood, because Roderick is suffering from some unknown malady, the nature of which we will eventually learn. But when he comes up to the House of Usher and sees it, he talks about this crack that runs from the roof of the building and then zigzags down through the building and on into the ground and into the lake, mm-hmm. which is a kind of an absurd thing to think about. But that's the kind of the world that we inhabit here is where...
Yeah, and the precise sort of nature... I thought it was interesting that Poe describes the precise nature of the decay of the house. Not so much, aside from that crack, it's not that any particular sections are tumbling down or that it's sagging its foundations or anything, but rather that each brick in place is decaying on its own, almost. Like each element of the house has shown obvious wear and decay and crumbling, but the edifice itself seems to maintain the same proud shape. I thought that was sort of an interesting detail that he included.
Sure, and the narrator also spends some time talking about the moss and the fungus growing mm-hmm. on the masonry, and that kind of is brought up later when Roderick Usher puts forth his theory about vegetable sentience,
yes.
which we can talk about later. But when the narrator comes in, he is greeted by a very dour doorman who is there as sort of a portent of ill will and never shows up again. He leads him into the study where Roderick is there. And we have this lengthy description of the phrenology of Usher's head and his features. We're told he has a soft Hebrew nose.
Mm-hmm. Which I thought, I was reading this and I thought, this is probably something that I could pick up on a lot more if I were versed in mid-19th century, calipers based racial science, but alas, I don't know enough about brachycephaly versus any other skull shapes to tell you much about what the hell this means.
Roderick Usher tells his friend that he suffers from hyperesthesia or mm-hmm. Which is when his senses are too finely attuned and he can't eat anything because the taste is too strong for him. He can't listen to music because it's too loud for him. He has to sit in the dark because light is too strong for him. Mm-hmm. It's just, he's kind of this hypersensitive guy. And he also suffers from sort of this general bout of melancholy. But beyond all that, he is, in mourning because his sister, we're told on the verge of death.
Yeah.
We just kind of accept this. Because the Madeline is the name of the sister, mm-hmm. We're told that the doctors have been confounded in any attempts to find out what's happening to her, that she seems to just sort of be wasting away, losing the will to live almost. This is one of the things that reading this through this time, I suddenly had like my ears prick up almost at this, because we'd also been told that the family line of the Ushers never had any branches, that it was always like a straight line father
right.
to father.
Or that it had any cadet branches were short-lived and never amounted to anything or something.
the family had always been this tiny little microcosm, and now we're just left with these, with this brother and sister. And of course I start to think, like, wait, is he implying that the family has been right. has been inbreeding? Is this constant incest, and is the wasting away of somehow related to that, you know? Or is it either her being unable to live with that, or some sort of, you know, I keep grasping all these things, right. You know, because I want to make some sense out of this. And Poe, of course, I don't think means any of this, but but I can't help, you know, I'm a 21st century reader. I can't help but start to, like, want to delve into the psychology, or I want to build up a story where I don't think any story is implied.
Yeah. But at the same time, though, I think, you know, as you mentioned earlier, Poe was kind of fascinated with the idea of declining Europe and all that. And, you know, I don't think, I mean, I think even in the 1840s, like, the, you know, the Habsburg royal family was famous for its various inbred ailments that it had been passing on for centuries. The famous Habsburg jaw, for instance. Although I think the most inbred line had actually died out by this point and been replaced by Bourbons in Spain. But yeah, I don't know if it was. I think there's probably some grounds to believe that perhaps this was a kind of oblique reference to the insularity of these high families contributing perhaps to their this wasting away, this wasting away of the blood, even as they struggle mightily to shepherd the blood and contain it and keep it strong.
Madeline shows up basically for one scene, walking off in the distance, and doesn't acknowledge the narrator.
She
in
basically
any way.
Like walks past the open door and kind of like glances, you know, wistfully or something, and then scooches on, and that's the last we see her.
Shortly after she makes her appearance, Roderick tells the narrator that we're not going to see her alive again. Again, I keep feeling like, whereas Poe has no problem with his characters living in a world of where everything seems to be completely driven by fate, mm-hmm. and where the characters are completely fatalistic in their own way about dealing with that, as a reader, I keep thinking, like, why do you believe this? Why aren't you going in to check that there's not some sort of Munchausen by proxy thing going on here? Right. You know, it's like,
or you got some kind of, you know, like the local you know, leeches guild has really, like, oh, we hit pay dirt here, time to milk this one for all we got. Yeah,
for such sad, melancholic people, they sort of give up really quickly on everything. So
and I think I know some of the vocabulary that Poe used that I had to look up, that it refers to Madeline's ailment as a catalepsy, and this is evidently a condition that wherein you have muscular rigidity and fixity of posture, as Wikipedia told me. So I guess part of the idea is that a cataleptic fit might resemble rigor mortis, in that your limbs will be sort of frozen in place.
In the midst of this story, we're treated to Roderick singing one of Poe's earlier poems called "The Haunted Palace." What I kind of like about this is, as short a story as this is, it has stories within stories, mm-hmm. and Poe refers to these as though they were works that anyone would be familiar with, although right. they are completely his own creation.
That's a strange sort of hubris, but I'll allow it.
Roderick discusses with the narrator how he believes that the vegetation, that all vegetation has sentience, and that that vegetation has lent its sentience to the house that they live in, that Roderick sees the House of Usher as having a kind of a consciousness that is shared between himself and his sister.
Mm. Yeah, well, I have rounding out that paragraph that appears, I have the text in front of me. It says, as the narrator, in the narrative voice, "Such opinions need no comment, and I will make none."
So. Yes. Now, Then the next day or however long it takes, because time has no meaning in this story.
Yeah.
Roderick tells the narrator that his sister has in fact died, and that they are going to follow the family tradition of interring her in a vault for 2 weeks before she is finally buried.
And I think it was also another reason given was that the nature of her ailment was of such a curiosity to all the physicians that they wanted to examine the body at length after she passed away, I guess to perform some sort of autopsies or something like that. But
and this is where we're told that the vault had previously been used as a dungeon
in
medieval times, and as a munitions to hold munitions, and so the entirety of it was copper lined. Which I'm not exactly sure what that's why it would be copper lined, because I suppose the idea is that if the munitions went off, it would keep it from destroying the house or something. But
the guess I would make is that maybe that would cut down on the chance of striking a spark on the stone.
Right.
But that's just me spitballing. I don't know.
yeah. No, that makes more sense. The in any case, there's this. They live in history,
right.
and they were at this kind of this belated period here where Roderick sees himself at the end of this history. But this might want to read this as sort of the continuation of the evils of feudalism.
Sure.
But you know, that's me again wanting to put themes on this, and I don't know that Poe wants me to put themes
on
this.
Yeah.
One night shortly after that, Roderick wakes up the narrator because outside the tarn, the lake around the house is glowing from incandescent gas that's coming up from the swamp, I guess.
Yeah, and it somehow includes in the glowing, like it's part of a storm that's blowing up, and so that effulgence that glowing also is sort of found surrounding the house, and the fungi and the mosses around the house are glowing with it as well.
Right. And to calm Roderick's mind, the narrator picks up this tome of this romance of Arthurian legend called the Mad Trist, which is either about a knight named Ethelred, or it's about Lancelot. It keeps like switching back and forth who the hero this is, and the narrator himself admits that this is a kind of a dreary thing to be reading, but it seems to be the only thing that makes Roderick happy.
it was the closest thing at hand. Like he was saying, like right. I was trying to distract him and like, well, let's read your favorite romance. Yes, the Mad Trist.
And this is another thing where Poe says, as everyone is quite aware of this part of the story, but this is apparently just like something he made up.
Yeah.
It involves a sequence in which the knight, whether it is Ethelred or Lancelot, has to break into this palace and fight a dragon. And at that moment, at the moment in the story when the dragon is killed by a mace, there is a crash from outside.
Yeah. There's I think the sequence is like when the hero smashes down the door, then there's a kind of, they hear a smashing from somewhere in the house, and the narrator is not quite sure, like, oh, maybe I just imagined it because I'm reading this, you know, stultifying story. And the hero smashes the skull of the venomous dragon with his mace, and then there's another kind of another noise there, and I think later he describes that the knight has gone into this, you know, in the story, the knight has gone into this chamber that is floored with silver, and the walls are all gold, and there's a shield of brass, a magic shield of brass that will be his reward after slaying this dragon, and as he walks toward it, it drops of its own volition off the wall and clatters onto the silver, so the two metal things are clattering together, and that's when they hear a horrible, rending, metallic shriek like a rusty gate swinging open.
Right. And then Roderick suddenly starts to exclaim that he is convinced that they have placed his sister in the family vault, still alive, that he has heard her these many nights. scratching at the inside of her vault, but for some reason felt powerless to do anything about this, possibly out of the sense of guilt and shame of having put her there in the first place. Because of his hypersensitivity, he has heard her when no one else has, but now that the narrator can hear her coming,
right,
he admits this, and he claims she's right outside the door, and lo and behold, she is right yeah. outside the door. If you go to Netflix right now, there's an anthology of Poe animations called Astonishing Tales or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they did an animation of this that was narrated by Christopher Lee. And there they kind of take the point of view that she's just sort of an apparition that Roderick sees. Ah. But that seems to not be what Poe had in mind.
Yeah, that's not well supported by the text, as it mentions that, you know, the, you know, Lady Madeline of Usher appears and there's like blood all over her white robes, like as though, like, you know, she's been tearing at her coffin lid for days, and then, you know, and has injured herself in her escape process.
And when the end comes, it comes really quickly in the yeah. story, because at the end of the penultimate paragraph, she shows up, falls on her brother, and we're told that he dies as they fall to the ground.
Right.
And then the narrator, so horrified by what he sees, runs out of the house as fast as he can, glances backwards, and watches as the house falls in two along the crack that breaks open so we can see the red sun peeking through, and it just falls into the lake. And it happens in the course of maybe four sentences.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's really, it's, and then we're out, you know, scene. Yeah, I mean, it just describes the, you know, the house being swallowed up by the waters of the Tarn, and that was the end of the House of Usher. it's pretty affecting. I mean, it's a fascinating image, of just this, and you get sort of the sense of the, you know, the ambiguity of calling it the fall of the House of Usher is, of course, I'm sure fully intentional, that the, you know, these two individuals who, I think it was revealed at some point that, they were twins, that they've been born as fraternal twins. These twins represented, you know, the last gasp of this ancient family, and that as they, you know, the only thing keeping the house up was the continued existence of this family, and when those two died, then so too goes the house. And I found myself wondering, what all happened to the doorman? Did he get swallowed up in the Tarn? Is he okay? We never know.
The way that this story ends, I think, really shows how little Poe cares about anything other than that climatic effect.
Right,
you know, it's like he got there, it's done. There's no denouement. There's no attempt to say, you know what this all meant? This is what it all meant.
Right.
You would even forgive the narrator for interjecting a little bit about that really screwed me up, and
I have to have some sort of therapy for years. I mean, he's bothering, you know, in the sort of the, and I guess in the conceit of the story, he's bothering to write this down to tell us something about it. Like, you think he would at some point say, like, and you know, that really made me think about X, Y, and Z, but but no, he just he wants to, it's almost like he wants to get out of telling the story as fast as he got out of the house, you know, and he's out.
Yeah, well, and it's particularly stunning given the hyper prolix nature of the prose up to this mm-hmm. point. You know, there's we'll get back to this at the end of this episode when we talk a little bit more about the style. But Poe spends a lot of time at the beginning of this book, or at the beginning of the story, easing his way into the narrative. You know, it's like very slow to get there, about and a lot of the narrator saying, I don't know why I felt so dreary looking here, but maybe it was this, maybe it was that. You would think the narrator would have more to say at this point, but
right, yeah, it is interesting. Like, there was, you know, I think there was a lot more time spent than I would have imagined talking about how Roderick played guitar. And I imagine, like, you know, it's the narrator is there. He's like hanging out with his friend, just kind of bored, sitting there while he dicks around on his guitar and sings these weird little songs. And I was like, yeah, Poe, we've been there. I remember having to hang out with that guy in his dorm room. You know, you just have to put up with it for a while. but it was strange that there was so much time spent on that, and yet what would seem to be the drive of the story, like the its reason for being, is treated in an almost offhand manner. But again, that might just be for the effect, you know?
Right. Now, let's move on to the Mask of the Red Death, mm-hmm. which is a much shorter story. I was actually quite surprised at how short this story
Me too.
Was. because this story actually... You know how you talked about the Raven, seeing the Raven when you were a kid mm-hmm. on The Simpsons? There was a animated version of The Mask of the Red Death that ran on PBS back in like 77 or something like that.
Wow.
On Halloween.
Okay.
And I saw that when I was a kid, and it really messed me up.
I was going to say, like, this is I think easily like the I think it's a little interesting to me that The Mask of the Red Death isn't used more as the kind of touchstone of Poe reading, because it's a very effective and almost kind of economical shot of like, hey, here's why Poe is fucked up, you guys. You
know? It's true. And if some things were spotty or just the barest framework in The Fall of the House of Usher, this is such a sketch. This mm-hmm. is such a tiny little sketch, but a very nasty and effective little sketch. Mm-hmm. Now this takes place more explicitly in sort of a Renaissance Italian city state kind of situation. Yeah. We're told that there's this Lord Prospero who is the I guess the ruler of a small, and I'm assuming it's an Italian state. Again, it's because it's called Prospero,
right? And mentioned that he retires to the deep seclusion of one of his castellated abbeys, which is a kind of typical Renaissance Italian type of building, to have a fortified abbey.
That's right. Right. Now, abbey, of course, doesn't necessarily mean a place where monks live together. It can just mean any kind of a group dormitory in this Renaissance medieval sense.
Okay.
But I mean, I only get that from Wikipedia myself.
Gotcha. Well, I mean, it's the kind of thing that in my own sort of recreational studies of the time and place, there was, you know, these sort of great magnates would invest heavily in, you know, sort of sponsoring abbeys, and then, you know, would be happy to call on their spiritual power or light, you know, to sort of give a gloss of Catholic respectability to whatever awful thing they were about to do. So it's
Sure, definitely. To set the scene a little bit here, anyone who has studied Renaissance art history, or anyone who has just studied the history of the Renaissance, knows that when you go back to the 14th and 15th century, the modern Italian state did not exist in any way, shape, or form. It was all these little city states, mm-hmm. and they were largely controlled by ruling families. And so the idea of having a fortified retreat was certainly an important one.
Right.
First of all, you were in a constant war with everyone else on the peninsula. And second of all, there were plagues coming up from time to time.
Right.
People needed to sequester themselves. The titular Red Death is not any particular plague. Some people have thought that it might be consumption. Some people think it might be related to the bubonic plague. Mm-hmm. The symptoms he describes are not the symptoms of the bubonic plague, though.
Yeah, I mean, it's I think it's pretty clearly like it's an imaginary disease. Like it's a disease dreamed up by Poe to be as horrifying as he can think of it, because it's I guess I can I have it pulled up here. The first paragraph is given to describing this disease, that there were sharp pains and sudden dizziness, then profuse bleeding at the pores with dissolution. The scarlet stains upon the body and especially upon the face of the victim were the pest ban which shut him out from the aid and sympathy of his fellow men. And it mentions that the whole process from onset to death is half an hour. So yeah. You spend half an hour bleeding from every pore in your body and you die.
But things are good for Prince Prospero, because he's got this idea. He's going to bring together, like, some, they were told, like a thousand of his courtiers. Mm-hmm. And they all hole up in this abbey of his, and they're not just going to wait out this plague. They're going to have like a big mask, a big celebration, mm-hmm. a ball. They're going to flaunt their flaunt death, basically.
Right. Because they'll stockpile all the goods they need to really to delve in the garden of earthly delights while they're waiting this out.
Right, and they're going to do this all sort of eyes wide shut style. They're going to have everyone hanging out in masquerade costumes, and then we're told that the inner palace in which this mask is taking place has a suite of seven rooms. And the seven rooms each have a different color associated with them, until you get to the last room, which is, what is it? It's black. It's, the last room is black.
Right. It's draped. It's described as like it's a series of rooms that, like, sort of apartments, but they're arranged in almost a kind of fan arrangement, so that you can't see straight through all of them when all the doors are open. But these are the rooms that everyone's milling around in while they're, you know, having their fun. And each one, like, there's a hallway running on sort of parallel to all these, with a big stained glass window next to it. And so in that hallway are big braziers lit to shine through the stained glass. And each of the rooms, like, there's like a blue room, which is all draped in blue drapes and decorated in blue with a blue stained glass window that illuminates it, and a green one and an orange one and a white one. But the last chamber is one that is all draped in black, and it has a scarlet blood red stained glass window, and no one can bring themselves to set foot in it.
If it sounds to readers like we're spending an awful lot of time talking about the setting of this story, you have to understand the setting of the story is the story.
It is the story, right.
This story is maybe 2.5 pages long, 3 pages long, depending on how big your type is. And the discussion of these rooms makes up, I would guess, at least a third, maybe a half of the story.
Oh, easily. And I guess I forgot to mention there is also a large ebony clock, which ticks away in this black draped room, which I thought was particularly interesting. Poe describes how, like, every hour on the hour, it will chime, and when it does, it just chills everyone. Everyone sort of stops dancing for a moment, and the orchestras stop playing the waltzes, and then everyone, like, sort of stands silently while it chimes, and then when it's over, everyone titters nervously, and then it's back to the party.
This is a very interesting point about the story, because if the Mask of the Red Death is about these rich people trying to put themselves outside of harm's way, they are nonetheless kind of making a big joke out of everything, and it's sort of like this crazy grotesque mask in which everyone is dressed in kind of fiendish or devilish costumes, and the rooms become sort of progressively sinister, is supposed to be a kind of a kind of a game of chicken that they're playing with themselves about who's going to really delve into the darkness of this.
Right.
And Prospero, the Prince Prospero has set this all up, and I guess by implication, he has this mordant humor about what's going on, and he really wants to play with this obvious image of mortality in the clock. But it's all going to be on his terms. Because we're told while the party is going underway, suddenly people start to become nervous because they've noticed a new figure walking around the room.
Yeah, and this is, and Poe mentions it's been months of this. Like they've been having this daily mask, this daily parade of vanities and drink and of course, you know, there's only 1,000 people there. You've met everybody, but all of a sudden someone new shows up, which will put anybody off. But
and the new person has a costume that has a mask that looks like that of a corpse, we're told, and he's dressed in a funerary shroud with blood stains all over it, and everyone is kind of gasping because this seems like a terribly bad joke to be playing.
in this parade of bad taste, this is too gauche for them.
Well, that's the thing about this is that's what makes Prospero incensed, is he feels like, okay, we're all having our fun, but this is too far. And it is, the weird thing is this character has been wandering around saying nothing, doing nothing. And he actually, Prospero demands to know who he is in the black room. And the character, whoever this character is, starts walking out through each room in turn, kind of leaving, as almost like he was going to go on his own. But Prospero is so incensed by this person's insolence, he draws a dagger and starts chasing him. And it's only when he catches up to the figure and the figure turns around that Prospero is suddenly struck by the Red Death and falls to the
and
ground.
He catches up to him right on the cusp of... He's been walking through each of the rooms from the blue room on the far end, and he's got into the cusp of the black and red room.
The other revelers, seeing Prospero lying dead on the ground, strike out at the new character and try to pull his mask from him, only to find that there is nothing underneath the mask, that it's an empty shroud. And then suddenly, one by one, they all are taken ill and die of the Red Death themselves.
And then also the ebony clock, as when the last of the revelers finally succumbs, the ebony clock stops. Also, that's the very end there with that the black clock. And that's the entirety of the story. Like but it's perfect almost. I really, really loved it reading it again. It's really terrific.
There was a famous edition of Poe that was had illustrations by Aubrey Beardsley.
Oh, wow.
And and this particular story has some of the most famous illustrations by Beardsley. You can see why this would appeal to Aubrey Beardsley. It's completely up his alley. But the again, this is a story that seems to scream for some sort of a thematic interpretation about whether or not this is about the futility of trying to escape death or the hubris of the rich. Mm-hmm. And people have tried to assign meanings to the seven rooms because it seems like there's numerology involved when you list these rooms,
especially choosing
stuff.
The number seven, which is of course, deeply ensconced in a great many numerological schema.
But again, I don't know. It feels like any attempt to really pin it down sort of lessens the effect.
Yeah, and I think we were, I don't know, and we were sort of talking a little bit before the show, before we started recording anyway, about that kind of almost willful disregard for there being a lesson to be learned. And I think I hate to bring it up again, but it's a touchstone that I think a lot of our listeners know. But there's the kind of H.P. Lovecraft built a lot of his dread out of the idea of sort of using the concept of the old gods to kind of personalize the ineffable, completely indifferent, like crushing indifference of the cosmos to anything humans had to say or do. and I think Poe prefigures that in a lot of ways, especially with the Mask of the Red Death. Like it's a story that, I mean, in a way it might be a fable of, you know, I think in the hands of, say, I don't want to say a lesser writer, but a writer with different priorities, this could very easily be in the vein of any number of kind of didactic Christian fables about the vanity of worldly attainment or of, you know, bodily enjoyment or anything like that, that, you know, death comes for us all, you know, and all that. But you're right. There's something does not, that message doesn't quite connect either.
I think the comparison with Lovecraft is completely apt. I think that Lovecraft owes an enormous amount to Poe.
Oh, absolutely.
And in both of these stories, we see that preoccupation with architecture as being a vector through which horror is conveyed. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly what a lot of people associate with Lovecraft. And the other thing that I would say, and here we should probably go ahead and listen to the reading we have this time.
Oh, yes.
Which is from the beginning of it's actually the opening to The Fall of the House of Usher. And there's another way I think that that Poe and Lovecraft are the same. Let's listen to this.
During the whole of a dull, dark, and soundless day in the autumn of the year, when the clouds hung oppressively low in the heavens, I had been passing alone, on horseback, through a singularly dreary tract of country, and at length found myself, as the shades of the evening drew on, within view of the melancholy House of Usher. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. I say insufferable, for the feeling was unrelieved by any of that half-pleasurable, because poetic, sentiment with which the mind usually receives even the sternest natural images of the desolate or terrible. I looked upon the scene before me, upon the mere house and the simple landscape features of the domain, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant, eye-like windows, upon a few rank sedges, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees. With an utter depression of soul, which I can compare to no earthly sensation more properly than to the afterdream of the reveler upon opium, the bitter lapse into everyday life, the hideous dropping off of the veil. There was an iciness, a sinking, a sickening of the heart, an unredeemed dreariness of thought which no goading of the imagination could torture into aught of the sublime. What was it, I paused to think, what was it that so unnerved me in the contemplation of the House of Usher? It was a mystery all insoluble, nor could I grapple with the shadowy fancies that crowded upon me as I pondered.
There's a lot of times in Poe where he's doing what my old fiction professors would say one shouldn't do, which is
right.
he's reaching for effect. He's explaining what his emotions are,
yeah,
and expecting you to fall in line with that. Now, in modern parlance, everyone says show, don't tell.
Right.
Don't tell the reader how they're supposed to feel. Show them something that makes them feel that way. But Poe doesn't do that. And it's not always effective, but when it's effective, it's very effective.
It really is. And this is a very, I mean, and starting off a story with these lines is, I mean, hats off to you, buddy. Like, this is, you know, people like, I mean, you just drop them right in. And of this particular passage, I was especially, there was an especially affecting portion of me where it talks about describing the effect of looking on this house as being like the bitter lapse into everyday life after an opium bender. And the idea of, like, coming to a place that feels like you're coming down is a very I would have never, myself, you know, I'm not a professional writer, and I'm not one of the greats like Poe, but, I mean, I would have never thought of describing a place like that. I never would have thought of using that particular metaphor for the genius Loki of a particular setting. It was really, very, very cool. But, yeah, I think there's, I think a lot of the push against, you know, that show don't tell axiom, I think exists as a kind of, it exists because it's hard to pull off. And if you're not a good enough or a confident enough writer, it's going to be very clunky and awful. And so I think a lot of writing training and a lot of writing advice is just saying, like, don't even try this. It's just, you're not going to make it.
It's true. I had a really good teacher though, once who I really respected because she fought back against this, and she mm-hmm. talked about how a lot of the great 19th century authors would just summarize, you know, as a way of getting out of one scene and into another. Yeah. I think that modern writers have a tendency to kind of get hung up in the moment, and because we're so character oriented and so psychologically oriented, we get muddled up, and that's not anything Poe cares that much yeah. about. He's like, on to the next
right.
thing.
Right, it's a kind of to bring up the weird fiction authors of the early 20th century, like Lovecraft. I found myself reading Poe. I realized, like, not only did Lovecraft owe a big debt, but my personal favorite of that cadre of contributors to Weird Tales magazine, Clark Ashton Smith, he very much writes in that same way where, there are some stories that he writes where there's not a single line of dialogue in them. It's just him telling you what happens, but they're sublime. They're marvelously effective at what they do. I think it's a tool that is I'm trying to think of like what's a good dangerous power tool that's also useful. I don't know. Maybe like a circular saw. Excellent. Yes, it's telling and not showing is a circular saw. If you know what you're doing, it's very useful, but you can also just completely cut the hand off what you're trying to do. I don't know, that metaphor got bad real quick.
Let's talk just briefly about Poe in school. Yeah. The thing is, he's a favorite for high schools and for middle schools because he has this reputation of being a horror writer. Mm-hmm. But I can remember as a kid thinking, oh, I know what this means. This means there's going to be monsters and there's going to be daring do and escapes.
Right.
And you kind of had this, I had this 20th century idea of what that meant. And I was completely unprepared for a story like The Fall of the House of Usher, which is just all mood and setting mm-hmm. and the slow burn. Or on the other hand, if you read a story like, say, Hop Frog, which
yeah,
is
yeah.
another Poe story that just is so nasty and so hateful towards humanity.
Right.
You just don't know what to do with that because it really is this completely, it's all effect. I remember in classes, the kids kind of liking Poe, mm-hmm. but also kind of like not liking his language.
Yeah. Well, it was that kind of, and I think one of the reasons why he's a favorite of high school teachers is because you can point to Poe and say, hey, look, see, I bet you thought literature was all stuffy old boring people talking. Well, look at this, you know, here's some gnarly shit, you know. And that's and I know that's something that I think a lot of high school teachers kind of like to do to try to get kids interested in 19th century literature. You're right, like there's a kind of, there's a difference, I think, between genre horror and reading a story that is horrifying. And Poe is someone who can really pull off writing a just horrifying story that's not necessarily... I mean, of course, you know, it's kind of one of those things where can you really classify him as a horror writer when he is much more a kind of foundational text of what became genre horror than anything else. So I always think that's unfair to call him like a horror writer. It's like, nah, Poe was doing a thing and then other people picked it up. And I think that's another danger of sort of teaching Poe in high school, that you have the danger of, like, you know, kids who have been brought up, like you said, like he's in the ether, like you just absorb Poe-ness if you come up in American pop culture. And so by the time you actually read the text themselves, you're like, you know, oh, boring. Oh, a spooky house. Oh, okay. Duh. Poe, you're not very original. When, you know, because you don't have the context to understand, like, well, no, he was playing with these things and inventing a lot of these things. And then everyone else copped it, you know.
I would encourage everybody to go out and get yourself one of these big anthologies of mm-hmm. Poe. You can either get it for free on Amazon Kindle, or you can go to your local library and pick up, as you did,
yeah.
I gather, a huge tome from the 1920s or 30s.
I did. And again, it's not too huge, but it's tiny print. But yeah, your library should have any number of old books, that they sent to the bindery years ago, so they came back with those nice leathery looking covers with an abstract pattern on them.
And then find yourself a couple of stories you haven't heard of by mm-hmm. him, and try those out, because that's where you can really get a really good feel for what he's doing with language, without the filter of knowing ahead of time that someone's going to get bricked up in a wall.
Right.
and then the other thing I would recommend everyone do is read the narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym. It was the only sort of novel length thing that Poe wrote. It's like a short novel about an Arctic expedition, and it is as weird as you can imagine. And if you think that Lovecraft owes something to Poe, hold on to your hats, because read that story and you will see.
Yeah, that's one I haven't read yet. I'm very excited to on your recommendation, John. Yeah, I guess I would say definitely, yeah, get yourself a Poe anthology. And they can be intimidating just because the man wrote so much, but each of the stories themselves are not that... I mean, you can read them in 15, 20 minutes. I mean, it's not a huge commitment of time or anything to read a Poe story. So even though, you know, it looks intimidating, it's really not. Like, it's, you know, one of the reasons why they're assigned in high school. Like, you can read them. They're very readable. But yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed him, especially Mask of the Red Death. I just think that might be one of the most perfect short stories I've ever read in my life. Absolutely terrific. And it also inspired one of my favorite songs by 2000s skronk rock band Les Avifaves, who of course had their great song Raging in the Plague Age, which is basically a kind of a real stomper of a song about the Red Death. So go check that out, everybody.
Thanks once again to my co-host, Daniel Dowdy. You can find his recently retired podcast, The Lesser Bonapartes, on iTunes or wherever else you shop for fine podcasts. Thanks to Michelle Dowdy for doing the reading. If you've been looking for a way to support Sophomore Lit, now there is one. The Incomparable Network has a membership system that lets you sign up for a monthly or annual pledge. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up for a membership. You'll be asked to pick shows on the Incomparable Network you'd like to support. If you only check the box for Sophomore Lit, your entire contribution will come to us after fees are taken out, of course. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, and you should be listening to other podcasts on the Incomparable Network, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows you want to support. As a thank you for supporting us, members will receive extras, including exclusive bonus audio tracks, a live bootlegged feed of The Incomparable, and other cool stuff. There are contribution levels of $5, $10, and $20 a month, and annual equivalents are available as well. Thanks in advance. If you'd like to get in touch with Sophomore Lit, you can do so by mailing me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Also join us on the Facebook page. Just search for Sophomore Lit. And remember, everything will be on the final.